you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
You have entered the Twilight Histories, an audio adventure that casts you as the hero. You will travel to strange, exotic worlds in the multiverse, some of which never existed in our timeline. A Carthaginian base on Mars, Egypt locked in an ice age, a Roman Empire that never fell. With the help of music and sound effects, you will be immersed in worlds out of time. You are about to hear part one of a multi-part series by Tristan Verboven that will take you back to the world of the Crusades. Tristan wrote this episode during a retreat at an actual Benedictine monastery in southern Quebec in Canada. It was inspired by his time with the monks as he kept a vow of silence during his stay. This is Gates of Heaven, Part 1, by Tristan Verboven. Enjoy.
The brief time between the morning service and the first meal of the day is just enough time to walk a path through the streets that wind down from the abbey, out onto the old Roman road, across the crude stone walls that keep the sheep in pasture, over the crest, to the ancient chapel, and back. On the way you pass villagers hauling great bales and rough sacks. You pass the merchants leaning in their doorways, hands resting on their belt pouches. You see the shepherd boys who wave to you each morning, and women in the fields who straighten their backs from toil for a moment to cross themselves. You see men propped high on hay carts, steadying themselves with pitchforks. If they catch your eye from under your dark hood, they might nod hello, but they know. They know you have taken a vow of silence, and that your mind is given to a higher calling. They know that you are devoted to saving the human soul. This is the life you've signed up for. You requested a journey into the Twilight Histories, a spiritual retreat, an escape from the stresses of the world. You said you wanted immersion into a world of peace and tranquility. This one is quite popular. A stay at a French monastery in the 11th century. L'Abbaye de Saint-Benoît, to be exact. And to live the life of a medieval monk. In your request for spiritual experience, soothing rhythms of life, and religious epiphany, you also asked if they could throw in a miracle. Well, we'll see what we can do. For now, let's get you into the rhythms of a monastic life. It is the year 1095. Your training began months ago. first lessons in Latin. Squatting at a tiny desk, poring over noun declensions, verb conjugations, ablative suffixes, irregular supines, and possessive pronouns, translating passages, reciting scrolls, scratching dictation into a slate. Then came penmanship. Curing goose feathers, carving tips, mixing ink, leaning up to the podium, slowly, carefully dipping into the glass well, gliding the tiny glistening flow across the page. The perfect curve, the perfect weight, the perfect form. And finally, illumination. From countless volumes you study the works, letters embellished in stunning complexity, pastoral scenes, hooded saints, strange beasts, biblical motifs, colors conjured from the Lord's earthly bounty, gold leaf pressed into swirling flourish, then trapped again between pages, and slid carefully back into the dark, dusty stacks for eternity. And so, you have learned to live by the letters and the numbers, every day the same. You rise from your Spartan cot, drape yourselves in a simple hooded robe. Morning communion, meals taken at a long table without speaking. And once a month, it is your turn to fast, breaking your vow only to recite the gospel to your brothers as they sup. There are 7 masses a day. Liturgies, prayers, chanting, the afternoon spent in devout labor, in the grand scriptorium, copying the old scrolls. In the summer months, they creak open the stained glass to air out the dusty stone, and in winter, you keep your toes toasty on a pan of coals. With a bit of luck, a cat will curl up on your lap as you work. You are dealing with the height of medieval technology. Papyrus scrolls, having barely survived from the time of Rome, must now be lovingly transferred to a new format called the Codex. This technique requires the specialized skills of cloistered monks. Each sacred letter is copied onto vellum, paper made from stretched hide, far more durable than papyrus, and instead of rolling and sliding the volumes into slots, the pages are pressed into a stack, bound and protected by a leather outer shell, these capsules that hold the word of God, we now refer simply as books. These books are carefully indexed and committed to the deepest, safest vault in the monastery. It is unlike any other library. The books are not there to be read. It is rare that a scholar should consult them. Not even the monk who copies them takes the time to read. These books, lovingly preserved for posterity, are there to survive the ravages of these dark times. They are the seeds for a more enlightened age. They are what is left of Rome. And so, you have chosen a secular scroll, Lucretius's De Rerum Natura. Though not a work of gospel, still an account of the glory of God. Every bit of this divine process brings you closer to the serene order that you seek. The crisp texture of the paper, the clicking and swirling of ink bottles, the delicate scratch of the pen as you apply each letter. The subtle creaking of the bench, the resounding echo of footsteps down the damp corridors, the soothing fraternal harmony of prayer and chant. The same moment, over and over, without uttering a single word. For eternity. You are in heaven. But your peace is about to be disrupted. The town is abuzz. There will be a visit, an entire envoy from Rome. It is rumored that Pope Urban himself is on his way, and bringing with him an important dispatch. Finally, the day comes. A procession winds up through the main gates. First, horse hoof clapping the cobblestone, an escort of knights in white tunics, then a cohort of holy men, attendants and scribes, and finally, in a drawn cart, Pope Urban peeks his head from a flap, his eyes blessing the adoring townspeople. The party stops at the abbey, and each monk dutifully kisses the Pope's hand as he makes his way up the steps, placing his blessing upon the altar. Then, causing a growing crowd to form behind him, he descends a path by the rear entrance to a humble outcrop by the walls. This place provides a perfect parable for his voice to resonate. He waits as the crowd gathers, in the hundreds now, peasants, tradesmen, clergy, lords and ladies, knights and squires, beggars and children. They have made the journey from their villages to hear this announcement. Pope Urban, in his perfect linens, Bible and rosary in grasp, he raises his hands for silence, calling upon the Trinity to welcome these followers of God.
O Franks! O Christians of Rome! Chosen people of God, loved by the Lord for your many great deeds, and your Catholic faith and devotion to the Holy See, I call upon you with a message.
The crowd falls silent. The only sound now, the whistle of breeze and the snort of livestock.
It is with great sadness that I travel this distance to bring this news. Such a grave matter, brought to you all the way from Jerusalem, and Constantinople, those cities most sacred to all Christians. They are in peril.
There is a low murmur of concern from the followers. They have heard many times of the great, distant, and sacred cities.
The Persians, an accursed, swarthy race, enemies of God. Their spirit not aright, not steadfast with the Lord. They have invaded Christian lands, devastated them with swords, ravaged their women, and left their homes in fire.
As the crowd begins to indulge in this sordid tale, the Pope continues.
Christians carried away as slaves, put to death. Churches turned into mosques, their altars set ablaze. They circumcise them. They desecrate our holy book with the blood.
Some gasps can be heard among the more delicate souls.
Oh, I have heard horrible tales. Cutting open the bellies of children, tossing them in ovens, tying their entrails to a stake and drawing them to a forced march. As their archers train their aim on the hopeless bodies.
From the crowd comes a murmur of disgust and fascination. And so, Pope Urban gives them more.
Others have their necks pulled from their shoulders so as to remove their heads by a single stroke of a sword. As for the fate of the women, it is best for their dignity that I say nothing at all.
The crowd has now erupted into a noisy rumble, but Pope Urban raises his hand for silence.
And from our Greek Christian brethren in the Far East, they have taken tracts of land so vast that it would be weeks to cross them, stolen at the point of sword and spear. The Eastern Roman Empire, the Holy Land, in the hands of Muslims.
The Pope locks eyes with the noblemen and the knights, whose ears have now perked up, and he betrays a sly grin.
What business is this of ours, you may ask? Lands so far away. No enemy of ours, you say. Surely these Muslims do not come for our homes, for our lands. What duty is it for us to avenge this? I will tell you. Look at what the Lord has given you. Courage, military spirit, agile bodies. You have bravery not given to other nations. Let your minds be stirred by your strength and the strength of your forefathers, our great warrior ancestors, who have resisted the ravages of these foreign raiders.
He now points his finger towards the men at arms.
Oh, bravest of our knights, descendants of the unconquered, the unconquerable, are you weaker than them? Remember that your courage runs in your blood, in your families, and in your children.
He lowers his hand, closing his fingers slowly in a fist. He shakes his head.
Some of you, surely, will not heed this calling. I understand. You are kept back by love. For your children, your wives, and your lands. Do not do this for me. Take not counsel from my words alone. Remember instead the words of Matthew and the Gospel. You know these words.
He crosses himself, opening the book in front of him. The pages flap in the breeze.
He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me.
He reads aloud, his voice getting louder.
And everyone that hath forsaken houses, or brothers, or sisters, or fathers, or mother, or wife, or children, or lands for my name's sake, shall receive a hundredfold, and shall inherit everlasting life.
He takes a pause, muttering a prayer under his breath, then closes the book, kissing it. He holds it in the air.
For what land do we speak of? These possessions that hold you back. The soil can scarcely yield enough to support you, and so many mouths that you hate and quarrel over its spoils. We drench it in our own blood.
He tilts his head back, appealing to the heavens for strength.
And why? The holy scriptures speak of lands to the east, flowing with milk and honey. The very lands given by God to the children of Israel. The fruitful lands of Jerusalem. A paradise of delights.
He lets these words sink in as he stands in silence. And already some of the fighting men and knights are moved by these words, straightening their backs and puffing their chests.
Set out, great warriors, on the road east to the Holy Sepulchre. Let your dissensions cease. Leave your quarrels and worries behind. Take the Holy Land back from the wicked. Be God's own agent upon this earth.
The crowd begins to erupt in a rumble of excitement as more and more men join the chorus.
The royal city of Jerusalem, at this moment, is made pagan by enemies who know not God. A land made holy by our Savior, made sacred by his suffering, redeemed by his death, glorious with his tomb, and it begs for you to come to its aid.
The crowd is now chanting war cries, yelling taunts to the comrades in arms.
These dispatches come for you. Yes, you, especially for you. You, who God has granted great warrior spirit. And now, he offers you glory, remission from your sins, and great adventure.
The Pope's own voice is now drowned out by the cries. He tries to shout over the din.
To the saviors of the holy city of Jerusalem, he will open the gates to the kingdom of heaven.
Well then, so much for a quiet life of monastic tranquility. Before the Pope even has time to pack up and move to the next town, plans are already being forged for the great pilgrimage. The local lords and their knights have organized a small force to join the expedition of Raymond of Toulouse and the Bishop Adhémar of Le Puy. Raymond is by far the richest and most powerful man in Europe, a count who owns most of the south of France, and Adhémar, hand-picked by the Pope himself, the highest-ranking clergyman. The pilgrimage will begin come fall, once the harvests are reaped and the plans are forged. You've been assigned the job of chronicler, and you will join Raymond and Adhémar in their party. Thousands of knights, foot soldiers, monks, and clergy, devout camp followers, men, women, and even their families and their beasts of burden shall join the long, grueling journey to Jerusalem. A mule named Farrugo, for the reddish tufts on his brow, bears your modest pack, a bundle for a crude bivouac, and cases for your pages and pens, keeping your vow of silence until the Holy Sepulchre. You shall document your ordeal, keeping record of the pilgrims you meet on your way and their stories. For who are these hardy souls who take on this journey? They are from every type of house. Starting at the bottom are the itinerants, traveling workers and men of arms, having all their lives migrated amongst squabbles. They may now take on the ultimate holy war. Then there are the devout, having long dreamed of a chance to quench their sins. Second sons with no prospect of land nor status, wayward knights with no hope of wealth by conquest. Serfs abandoning their bond, dreaming of their own plot in the land of milk and honey. All shedding their trappings and placing their lives in God's hands for the long walk ahead. And then the ambitious men, some with deep pockets and loyal armies, men of war, men who live for no other pursuit, mounted men, suited in armor with squires to polish their swords, attendants to groom their horses, who have trained their whole lives to serve a lord, and to kill, to murder without hesitation, to bring great wrath upon the besieged. These are the men that God needs now. Taking the pilgrim route, well-worn Roman roads through France, then northern Italy, the groups are staggered so as not to overwhelm local markets and accommodation. For the first weeks, local lords welcome the flow of pilgrims, and you are given pastures to rest your beasts. Before sundown each day, you pitch your humble camp and take stock of the faithful who brave this trail. A tailor and his sons from Munster, a spearman from Burgundy, a washerwoman from Genoa, a merchant's son from Avignon, a horse groomer from Grenoble, a knight and his footman from Arles. You write each entry with care in your leather-bound book, closing it with a clasp, carefully returning your quill to its container, and firmly sealing your ink bottles, folding away your portable desk for the voyage ahead. By the time you reach the Adriatic, you are joined by thousands more pilgrims. Losing some, too, to the challenges of the mountain passes, abandoning the folly, running out of money, or falling victim to highway thieves. And the farther you walk from France, the colder come the receptions. And by northern Greece, in the final weeks before reaching the great city of Constantinople, you start to get a startlingly clear idea of just how many Christians have taken on this vow and the enormous scale of this enterprise. Having taken a northern route through Germany and Hungary, we meet the Flemish princes, three brothers, Godfrey, Eustace, and Baldwin from Boulogne. These counts from northern France, who sold their enormous inheritance and raised each an army for the great voyage east. You make careful note of the men in their party, their camp followers, and the holy clerks who accompany them, each receiving an entry in your book. Then there is Robert of Flanders, whose father before him had made the pilgrimage to the Holy Land. He, too, has raised a cohort of warriors for the great journey, taking a route through the south of Italy, crossing over at Brindisi, And finally, an imposing figure. Bohemond of Taranto, one of the Norman dukes who has made a kingdom in Italy. He is a man of overbearing volatility, even among other princes. He and his nephew Tancred, together being by far the smallest landholders and having only a few thousand knights among them, are somehow the most intimidating. And their ambitions, while draped in religious fervor, are clearly that of men on the make. You note in your book an account of his presence.
He is so built of mind and body, that of a man inclined to war. His wit assures a way of escape in every emergency. He is well informed and quite irrefutable. This man, of such a size and character as to cause concern in men of every station. Alone he, in fortune and eloquence, and in other gifts of nature, he stands above all others.
You chuckle to yourself as you stow away your pen and book for the evening. Oh, what an adventure this will be! And for these powerful men, men of valor and courage, united only under God, allies, nay, rivals for the plunder of the Holy Land. And as these armies approach the towering walls of Constantinople, the fighting men drape their armor in white tunics, emblazoning a cross upon their chests. Their arrival in the great city shall be the threshold into the Muslim world. They will have to fight through every manner of heathen. Seljuk Turks in Anatolia, Arabian horsemen in Syria, and the Egyptian defenders of the holy city of Jerusalem. And they have with them the glory of a most powerful God. The holy power of gospel, the divine intervention of the God of all gods, the only one who can perform miracles for his devout, who can bring humility to the powerful and grace to the wretched. They are all now united. And so, join me on this great quest as we venture forth on the Great Crusade.
That was The Gates of Heaven, Part 1, by Tristan Verboven. Please join the Twilight Histories for Part 2, coming up soon. And you can hear that as a pre-release in Patreon. I'm in the final stages of editing the last installment of Franklin's Tomb, and it will be posted very shortly in Patreon. This is a story that casts you as a crew member among the doomed Franklin expedition to find the Northwest Passage in the 1840s. It is grim and savage, and it's almost done. While I've been posting it in installments to our patrons, once I'm done, I'll patch it up into one giant 2-hour show that you can then purchase in our Patreon store. If you're interested in those insane 19th century Arctic expeditions, this Franklin's Tomb will give you a sense of what it was like. I'm actually slowly going through all our older Patreon shows and converting them into digital downloads you can purchase. So you'll have the option of either subscribing as a member, where you can get all of them plus pre-releases, or if you don't like memberships, and I know some people don't, but you still want to support the show, you'll be able to buy them as individual shows in the store. Shows like Franklin's Tomb, or the massive 2-hour and 40-minute Deep City, which is a fan favorite from the old days, or Nightmare at Hiroshima, which is one of the creations I'm most proud of. That's all in Patreon, And you can find that by going to patreon.com and running a search for Twilight Histories. Or you can go to the website at twilighthistories.com and follow the link. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.